All right, so hi, welcome to the Q Report. We are having a race today. So, Will, you're still on your way down to 23rd and 8th?
Yeah, I just got off the subway. I got to tell you, man, it's pretty slow.
Oh, no, I hear you. Don't forget, biking is the fastest. We know that for sure. So give us a call when you're at 23rd and 8th, and we'll be ready for you.
All right, I'll call you back.
All right, bye, Will.
Patrick, I think you should outline the, this is Mark, by the way, in the Q Report.
Yes, absolutely.
Outline the race for us.
Well, first, let's introduce everybody. This is the Q Report on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm here with my co-hosts, Mark Marabella.
Ciao, Bella.
And Ed Grant.
Hey, how you doing today?
Is that Ciao, Bella in Queens talk? Where are you from, Ed?
Me?
Yeah, born and raised. Where are you?
I was born outside of Boston, raised in Vermont.
Oh, very nice. New England all the way.
All the way, all the way.
So this is a very exciting. I think this might be the all-time most interesting Q Report, which stands for Quotidian Report. We're going to actually learn about today, among other things, the quotidian culture of bacteria. Just what they do on a day-in and day-out level.
We are. That's interesting.
Just what do they do? When I mean, obviously everyone knows the big things they do, like sustain life, but what do they do when no one's watching?
They're helping me digest this pizza right now.
Well, this Q Report has three components to it. One is kind of an introduction of .con as a concept, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, .con is...
it's something I do with the Producers Guild of America as the co-chairman of the documentary committee there. Which is a organization very similar to the Writers Guild or the Directors Guild. And myself and a lot of other people on the committee, we produce a lot of programming for those, and we wanted to make a show for the Heritage Network Radio, Producers Guild, doc, all everything doc, documentaries, all the people and the filmmakers and the stories.
And you kind of liken documentaries to oral histories.
Well, it is. It's, you know, people... people telling their stories, as they say, you know, to me, I mean, I really like, you know, there's a big trend to say that people said, oh, you know, we don't want to see any more talking heads. But, you know, I like, you know, seeing talking heads because especially if they know what they're talking about, it's an important thing. It's important to record them for the stories that they're telling.
No, absolutely. Well, I cannot wait for the .com. The theme of today's Q Report is origins. So we're really going to look at the origins of life, because what better way to start the Q Report than through studying the bacteria and the beginning of mankind? Because there would be no quotidian culture, Ed, if there wasn't bacteria.
There wouldn't be much of anything if there wasn't bacteria.
That's true.
Yeah, it's true.
And again, not to put too fine a point on it, but when life started, compared to what life was when it started, bacteria are very advanced. Just to give you an idea of that.
Well, and then there's two other things happening on the Q Report. Three other things. One is an obituary section, which we might cut to a little earlier. And we have a beautiful original piece by Knack Waxman, the owner of Kitchen Arts and Letters, to honor three closings, actually, of very historic bookstores. Very sad that we're losing
terrible
all
sign
these.
Of the times.
Where are you finding all this information out? All these closings? I mean...
I actually am part of a club that goes to the last meals of various restaurants that are closing. And I know that that's dangerous because, of course, they're trying to use all that old food like from the back of the freezer that they couldn't sell over the past 6 months. But, you know, I've always been on the lookout for, you know, dying things, you know, that shouldn't be dying, but that are dying because we're misguided and because of greed.
That's true, Patrick. I would say you walk the walk.
All right. Well, here we go. The other two parts, which are absolutely fascinating, of the Q Report. One is we're going to have a race between a car and a man. The man will be on a bicycle. The car will be, you know, a regular car. We're hoping the bike wins so that we can make the point that, you know, it's that guy, you know, who was it when he drove to D.C.? He was like the chairman of Ford or something, and he flew to D.C. And everyone was like, you should be taking a car. If Will wins the bike race against the car, we'd be supporting the point that he should have taken a bike.
Exactly. Well, this is like John Henry. Can he beat the machine?
Can he beat the machine? Who was John Henry?
I have to. Well, the race is actually going on as we speak.
No, it hasn't started.
Hasn't started yet. Okay,
he's
good.
Just got off the subway.
So good. Okay,
that's why we opened the queue.
John Henry, if you know, as the mythology, he was a mythological. I think he was a real guy, but of course, the story goes, it was John Henry who could drive a railroad spike faster than a steam hammer, right?
And he did it. But he died at the end. Hopefully, the same will not happen to Will.
Although with the traffic, I would argue, you know, the car has the worst challenge of it.
And then
Sunday's going to be an interesting day, though, for the race. Sunday,
very interesting. There's
traffic's a little weird. 23rd and 8th.
They start on 23rd and 8th. The car Chelsea. And the bike together. They can take their own route. They're both going to go over the Williamsburg Bridge, and they're both ending their race at Roberta's. So they're going to come to the studio.
Is the cyclist going to follow traffic signals the way he's supposed to?
No,
or
no.
Blaze on through.
Yeah, okay. Man.
Well, you know, keeping in
review,
that's
the advantage
of the bike.
Right, that's okay. The advantage.
Let's be real.
Now, technically in New York, you can get a ticket for that, but most often you don't. I've never seen anybody write a ticket.
Oh, I have.
Yeah? If he gets a ticket, he'll be praying that it's a fast one.
Yeah, coming off the Brooklyn Bridge, they'll have guys standing there sometimes, and they'll
Williamsburg.
Pull you over.
My wife's brother
No, but I'm just saying he's never seen it.
My wife's brother got hit coming off of that bridge, so that's why.
Yikes.
Brooklyn Bridge.
Oof, we actually heard of, you know, one of the waitresses at Roberta's was telling. She got hit by a car. That's not what this is about. This is about showing that we're hoping Will wins because he will have spent less money than the car man. He will also be healthier, but, you know,
and
will he
efficient.
Be faster?
Yeah. So yeah. I'm curious, Patrick, how did you get here today?
I took a helicopter.
Excellent.
No, I drove to drop the car off with Robbie, who will be driving, and then we drove over, and then I took a subway over. And then we're going to have Angela, who's going to talk about manners and etiquette. She's going to come on later towards the end of the
Everybody
show.
Everybody needs a little more of that.
And of course, your guest for DocCon is
Dr. David Diemer, University of California at Santa Cruz. He studies the origins of life.
Well,
trying to create it, actually.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a break and come back, and we will call into our racers, do one more segment, call in with our racers, do an obit, then call David Diemer.
Let's do it.
See if
let's
that phone thing
it.
Works.
Outside another yellow moon, it's punched a hole in the nighttime, yes. I climb to the window and down to the street. I'm shining like a new dime. The downtown trends are full for all those Brooklyn girls. They try so hard to break out of their little worlds. Well, you wave your hand and they scatter like crows. They have nothing that will ever capture your heart. They're just thorns without the careful of them in the dark. Oh, if I was the one you chose to be your only one. Oh yeah, can't you hear me now? Can't you hear me now? I see you tonight on a downtown train. Every night it's just the same. Your stairs in your doorway. I walk down your street and past your gate. I stand by the light of the four-way. You watch a massive fall. Oh baby, they all have heart attacks. They stay at the carnival, but they'll never win you back. I see you tonight. Like rain.
come a little bit.
So, we're back. Mark Marabella, Ed Grant, and most importantly, Robbie and Will, who are man versus car.
Fantastic.
We're going to try to prove that humane, good ecological, good exercise is better than a car. Robbie, Will, are you with us?
I'm with you guys.
Awesome. So what's the actual distance that you guys are traveling?
Yeah, how far are you guys traveling?
It's about 5 or 10 miles, maybe.
5 or 10 miles. Where are you guys?
I don't know. We're going from the west side of Manhattan into Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Tell us a little bit about your routes. What do you guys have in mind?
What do we have? I was just going to bike till I hit the Williamsburg Bridge and then take a leisurely stroll across and
get down. Ooh, Robbie.
Keeping it fair. Excellent.
Robbie, are you going to be leisurely?
I'm going to be leisurely, of course. I'm in this big red Volkswagen. Of course I'm going to be leisurely.
Where are you guys?
Sorry?
Where are you guys starting from, just for the record, exactly?
We are right now just off of 8th Avenue and 23rd Street.
Which corner?
In Manhattan.
Which,
yeah, we're outside the Clearview Cinemas on 23rd.
Wow, so you're on the south side and the west side. So you're on the south, southeast. Wow, all
right. 23rd, you can go right across on 23rd two ways.
Yeah, no, very interesting. Well, guys, this race is historic. It has epic consequences for bikes or cars. Will, what kind of bike are you riding?
I'm riding a Franken bike. I pieced it together myself. The chain's a little wanky, and I haven't ridden it in about a year, so we'll see how this goes.
Wow. What are you riding? What are you driving, Robbie?
I don't know what year it is, but it is the biggest, reddest Volkswagen I've ever seen in my life. It's a Mercedes, not a Volkswagen. A Mercedes, yes.
It's something German.
Excuse me. It's beautiful. It's German, and it's beautiful. I'm ready to rock.
So how's the wind conditions out there for the bike?
I don't know that wind plays a factor in bikes. I'm just not that fat.
what a! But I mean, basically, it's even. The temperature is.
It's beautiful riding weather.
Yeah, it's beautiful right now. It doesn't look like rain. I mean, it looks like a pretty fair conditioned situation.
Actually, our own Ed Grant just rode here, and it was a very fast trip. He said.
Ed, any traffic things?
It's a pleasant ride.
Nah, it's empty out there. So.
Yeah, Sunday's an interesting day. You got construction, guys. You got no traffic, I don't know.
It's going to be very interesting. So you guys are going to make it to Roberta's, and the winner is the first person to come into the radio studio. Is that agreed?
That sounds good. Yeah.
All right, guys. So, Robbie, are you in the car?
I'm in the car.
Will, are you ready and on your bike?
Yeah, more or less.
All right. Well, then, it's... 124, and Godspeed, and much safety, and ready?
Send them up.
On your mark.
Get set. Okay.
Go!
Right. And they're on their way. Parking's part of it.
We're off.
Woo-hoo. We're off. Robbie, we're going to call you. Call me when you cross the bridge. All right.
You can hear him pedaling away.
On that note...
I hope if it's a time when they get to the door, they really slug it out trying to get back here to
the radio.
It'll
be fun to watch. We can describe it as they come in.
Oh, my God.
The parking,
really
the parking should be fine today, too, out here. Yeah. It's like, you know, that's always the
he
issue is the parking.
To park.
He's got no, park. No, he's got to park. It's part of it.
Yep.
All he's right, got to find something, someplace to put that big vehicle.
Just prepare for that car to get towed in front of the fire hydrant right outside of Roberta's.
Exactly.
So we just said goodbye to Will and Robbie. Now we're going to go to our obituary section, which is a perfect segue from a race. But actually, three very sad things happened. Paddleson's Music Store closed. And there was this article in the New York Times. That's Paddleson's is right in front of Carnegie Hall. It says, "The power of digital retail has made places like used bookshops, record stores, and sheet music dealers little more than quaint relics. With the closing of Paddleson's, the only remaining serious store for classical music in Manhattan is the Juilliard School at Lincoln Center. It's really That's very amazing. Sad. Just Have one, you guys ever been?
One no, store.
I'm afraid I haven't.
Nope.
I mean, but such a historic place.
That's the place across from, tell everybody it's the place across from Carnegie's, right?
Yeah, place right up yeah. across from Carnegie. It's been that there, place it's been closed there this week. Yeah, yeah for since 1938. A second place that's closed is Cook's Library and Bookstore in Los Angeles. And after 20 years, this little jewel of a cookbook store on La Cienega closed. And that's very sad. Have you guys ever been out there?
Not to Cook's specifically. To La Cienega, yes. It goes on forever.
And
hopefully they're not relocating, they're just closing up.
Yeah, no, they're completely closing up. And also closing is Manny's, which is
Manny's Music.
It's basically the beginning of the end for Music Row.
Yeah,
in New York City,
46th Street. And so, where most famously the Electric Lady studio was, where Jimi Hendrix recorded. That's that place.
Interesting. So we asked Knack Waxman, the owner of Kitchen Arts and Letters, a bookstore in New York City, actually on 92nd and Lexington. He wrote this, you know, very warm kind of obituary, which, you know, I thought I would just read. A lot more than banks and brokerage houses. Hold on one second. I can hear some dialing.
We have a call coming in or going out?
Probably going out to talk. Okay. It's not on the air. I'm learning. I'm learning more about radio each day. This is Knack Waxman obituary to Paddleson's Music and Cook's Library. A lot more than banks and brokerage houses are going down the tubes in the face of a runaway economy, telling us at last that the party's over. Two smaller but probably sadder business closings have been announced within the last couple of weeks, one on each of the coasts. Cook's Library in Los Angeles, a food-related bookstore, gave it up after 20 years of serving the needs of chefs and other professionals and feeding the pleasures of enthusiastic home cooks. And in New York City, Joseph Paddleson's Music, opened since 1939, has said that it is giving up the ghost. A virtual warehouse of sheet music, orchestral scores, and every sort of music in print, this richly jumbled curiosity shop, just out the back door of Carnegie Hall, has catered to the requirements of three generations of pianists, choral singers, bassoon players, jazzmen and women, and enthusiastic amateurs. These soon-to-be-gone businesses dealt with two of the most cherished realms of creativity and expression, food and music. Both were highly individual stores, utterly devoted to the goods they offered, goods that were clearly of more value to them than were the profit-making opportunities they provided their owners. Highly personal enterprises, they established close relationships to their customers, developing an understanding of their needs, and those who worked in those shops loved spreading knowledge, encouraging skills, and honoring appreciation of the best in their chosen fields. Their loss is a loss to a lot more than a few hundred cooks or musicians. With their disappearance, there is a diminution in what we all should value. Knowledge, caring, passion, a strain towards excellence, and a desire to communicate the best of what we have to future generations. It's difficult to apply such language to a failed hedge fund operation. It may be even more difficult to replace the cultural treasures we have allowed to expire. Oh, very, very sad. It's just very sad. Bookstores. I mean, I used to work as a delivery guy at a bookstore on the Upper East Side.
Well, I think it's the Amazon.comization of, you know, do you have to go to the bookstore anymore to sort of, you know, read? And now there's what's the electronic book? What's
Kindle.
The Kindle. There's the Kindle now. You know, We don't even have to physically have a book anymore even, so...
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that Amazon, that's actually what the woman from Cook's Library blamed for their downfall. And we actually have our foreign correspondent, domestic correspondent, Paul, from Los Angeles, who's going to call in and just tell us, like, what the story is down with Cook's. Paul, are you on with us?
I'm on.
Hey, Paul. Thanks so much for having, for for spending a few minutes with us. Tell us about this very sad closing on La Cienega.
Well, you know what? It is really sad, and the store's here on 3rd, and I got to tell you, it's not the only place that has a for rent or for lease sign in its window.
Really? Tell us, what other stores?
I'm looking here at the corner of 3rd and Orlando, and on either side, catty corner, there's for lease signs up. So Cook's Library, unfortunately, is not the only place to go down.
Now, what's the energy there? I mean, what did it represent to Los Angeles? And you know, what are some of the people saying out there about a loss of a cultural institution?
Well, you know what? It's really sad because Cook's Library was around for over 18 years, and this place had books piled to the ceiling. And they had book signings. They had chefs come in. I mean, this is sort of like the sur la table of where actual chefs would come to get their books, to get some ideas. And, I mean, after 18 years, it's a real sad thing that it's longer with us.
What's going to replace it?
You know what? We don't know.
What else is around there? I mean, do you see McDonald's is? I mean, La Cienega, that part of La Cienega is kind of an old school kind of neighborhood, correct?
Yeah, La Cienega is definitely old school. There's a lot of history. There's a lot of culture here. There's a lot of boutique kind of shops. But unfortunately, it's those boutique mom and pop places that are feeling the pinch and are just not able to sustain the kind of leases and rents that they're asked to pay.
And is LA losing a lot more of that throughout the city? I mean, is that part of a general trend within the city?
Absolutely. Los Angeles has been hit really hard. You know, our sales tax here in California just went up. Our unemployment's up to about 10.5%. So the closing of Cook's Library is putting not only the owners, but all of the people that spent years of their life building relationships with their customers, and it's a real sad thing.
What was
the signing? They had partnerships with the local farmers markets that they would get people to come over. So it's definitely not a good thing.
Could you went out there for a little bit? Did you say what was the unemployment rate now?
About 10.5%.
So wow, double digits.
1 in 10 people at least are unemployed out here.
Unbelievable.
Wow. Well, listen, thank you so much. I know how busy you are, Paul, to call in and give us that little bit of insight from Los Angeles is great. And, you know, we will call you next time we have an LA story. So you'll be hearing from Paul again on the Heritage Radio Network. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you very much for having me, you guys. Anytime.
Okay. Thanks. Bye now.
Thanks, man.
Well, with that note, let's cut to break and come back with happier times through .com.
My cheek. Don't waste another day. Don't wait until my auburn hair is turned silver gray. Love, love, my true love, though the days grow long. Love, love, please come to me before my youth is gone. Love, love, my true love, though the days grow long. Love, love, please come to me before my youth is gone.
Hi, welcome back to the Q Report. This is Mark Marabella talking to you live, or perhaps recorded. I don't know how you're listening to us. We're coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm with Patrick Martins and Ed Grant as the Q Report co-hosts. And this segment coming up, we're going to talk about origins of life. This is first in a series, hopefully, of segments and perhaps a new show on everything documentary. Currently, I'm working on a show, National Geographic special, on the origins of life, and we're bringing on a scientist who works in the origins of life, which is actually a field that they study and try to figure out. There's people all over the world who are stopped theorizing about it and trying to figure out how to do it. So the different theories and different processes are working in different labs. And David is calling in today from out in Santa Cruz, California.
Hello. Beautiful town. Here I am.
David Diemer, how are you? This is Mark Marbella on the Q Report.
Yep, just fine out here.
Very good.
A lot of sunshine. Hope you got some, too.
We do, actually. You brought some to Brooklyn. It's very nice. Spring has finally sprung. It's not as lovely as it is year-round in Santa Cruz, but it's lovely today.
Yep.
So you're with Patrick Martins and Ed Grant.
Hey, David.
Hi, David.
And thank you for your time, David. We've spent a lot of time together in the last few months, tramping around the various places in Santa Cruz and also in Hawaii. I wanted to start off just to give people a primer. What is? Tell us what your definition is of life. If you're looking for the origins of life, so you would have to have a definition. I know everybody does. What are the three or four basic definition or processes that you would define as something being alive?
Well, the fact is that there's a lot of problems trying to give a one or two sentence definition of life. What I do, I think, is give a description of life and then say that nothing else fits that description, and that's probably about as good as we can do.
Mm-hmm.
So, first of all, life is a molecular system of organic molecules that are in a place. We call it the cell. And the system captures energy and nutrients from the environment to undergo a growth process, and the growth is by polymerization, basically. Amino acids polymerize into proteins, and something called nucleotides polymerize into the nucleic acids that most people have heard of DNA, and certainly there's also RNA is another of the nucleic acids, very important. So life then grows. It reproduces itself, of course. At some point, the molecules in a living cell are able to replicate, particularly the genetic molecule, DNA, replicates. And this then lets the cell transmit information, genetic information, onto the next level, the next generation of life.
So as part of that is a metabolism as well, meaning bringing in nutrients from the outside and making it grow.
Yeah, the bringing in the nutrients, they undergo metabolism, basically. They are chemically changed by catalysts in the cell into more useful kinds of molecules. And they're also activated. So we always have to think about the energy input. Right now, life on the Earth is basically driven by sunlight, and we take advantage of the plants that produce what we call food then. And there are just a very few bacteria that don't really require sunshine as an energy source, but everything else requires energy.
Tell us about, we've been talking a little bit about bacteria in the show, and Just describe for us what life was like, how it started. I mean, bacteria, in fact, are very complex compared to likely the origins of life.
Yeah, we like to think of bacteria as the simplest form of life, but the fact is that bacteria are really incredibly complex with thousands of different proteins and thousands of genes that direct the synthesis of the proteins. A few people, a few of my colleagues, have tried to think about the very simplest possible form of life. Then you get down to around 200 genes that would be required for something that would a very primitive bacterium to be able to live in a rich nutrient environment. But the fact is that the early Earth was very scarce in nutrients, had plenty of energy, volcanic energy, light energy, and what we call chemical energy.
You have a very you have a very interesting take on that. I didn't mean to cut you off, but tell us a little bit about. Most people think that life began in the ocean, but you're not of that camp.
Well, you know, the way life, the way science works is you have alternative hypotheses, and you think about the ocean as the place where life began because there is so much of the ocean now. Fresh water is approximately 1% of all the liquid water, or of all the water on the Earth right now. So the best guess is that life began in the ocean. But when I try to do certain kinds of experiments that I think are on the pathway to life in the laboratory anyway, they don't work very well in ocean water. Ocean water contains a lot of what we call divalent cations like calcium and magnesium. And 4 billion years ago when life began, there's a lot of ferrous iron in the ocean as well. And all of these things...
Yeah, weren't the oceans like totally...
poisonous.
Like, I mean, poisonous almost. Yeah. I mean, to think that a fish could survive in both poisonous environments, I mean, what you know, it seems like a good point. What do you maintain if it's not oceans? What is it?
My guess is, and it's just a guess, we're pretty certain that volcanic land masses were rising above the ocean. And as soon as you have land masses out of the ocean, you immediately have the possibility of rain back then. Rain is basically distilled water. The sunlight distills water from the ocean. The rain falls as fresh water on the volcanic land masses, and it would form ponds and lakes, you know, small lakes that I think would be a place where, an alternative place for us to consider life beginning.
So as Darwin said, the warm pond.
Yeah, that's right. This is what I consider to be a plausible site. And that's why I go off to places like Kilauea, where you and I were last month, and up to Kamchatka in far eastern Russia, as well as some volcanic areas here in California.
Tell us a little bit. It was beautiful weather when we were there in Hawaii, right, David?
Beautiful. Making things grow very green indeed.
It was pouring constantly. We never saw the sun, actually. I don't know anybody who's gone to Hawaii and never saw the sun, but we were certainly of them.
That was us, right.
So are you saying that the volcano started life, like it was the catalyst to an enzyme type of combustion that then led to the simplest form of life, which is quite complicated, and that eventually evolved through evolutionary rules into us and things that we know on the Earth today?
Well, that's a big jump. Let's take it one at a time. First of all, I'm not talking about a live volcano with hot lava pouring down. That's not what we're really talking about. What we're talking about is the what we call the hydrothermal regions in which water interacts with the heat of the volcano.
Yeah, and to be specific, David, we were at the sulfur vents, not actually at the mouth of the volcano where the magma was. So that was just to be specific about our location.
Exactly so. So that's really the place that I'm thinking about anyway. And the nice thing about that is that there's what we call chemical energy available, and you always think first, what is the energy source that's going to drive the life process? Because you simply cannot make these reactions go uphill toward more complex molecules unless there's an energy source. And certainly volcanoes, these geothermal regions, have a lot of various kinds of energy. They also have what I call a fluctuating environment where water comes and water goes, and whenever you dry out water, you tremendously concentrate whatever's in the water, and that whatever's in the water then forms a film on these hot rocks that are part of this geothermal area. And that provides a kind of energy in which we are able to get polymers to be produced spontaneously. Just by adding amino acids, for example, or nucleotides, we're able to get pretty good-looking polymers out of that, and that's the first start toward, I think, what would be a simple form of life, is just that reaction.
It's very interesting. You know, also, it's also not exactly a non-poisonous area. There's a lot of sulfur gushing out of there and the like, but we're also fascinated by your work with, you know, the earliest sort of cell membranes, which were lipids. Talk about just basically oils and bubbles, which is, you know, very simple stuff. Talk a little bit about that.
Be happy to. The fact is that cells have a boundary layer that defines the inside of the cell away from the external world. And if you don't have that boundary layer, you just can't have a cell, really. You can't have life as we know it. So there had to be a first boundary-forming material.
Just to contain everything.
Yeah, it's got to be a container. The odd thing is it's a soap-like molecule. We call these fatty acids, and they're long-chain hydrocarbons with an acidic group at one end, and most people would just call these soaps.
Can you talk a little bit about Miller's experiment? Because fatty acids and lipids were one of the things that came out of that in 1953.
Yeah, not so much, though. He didn't pay much attention to what I'm interested in. He was more... on the amino acid in the monomers of proteins, and that's what most excited Stanley. So we really got interested in this probably, 30 years ago and began to publish on this. And one of the places we went to look for membrane-forming materials is a real sample of a prebiotic organic mixture which comes in on meteorites. So there's a very famous meteorite fall that occurred in Australia about 30 years ago.
Right, the Murchison.
Murchison meteorite.
David, and, we're gonna come back to that. Save that the idea that life was introduced from outside, perhaps. We're going to come back to that. We're going to go to...
It's what I've always believed, by the way.
The panspermia. It's a sort of like panspermia. We'll come back in a minute, David. Thank you.
Okay.
Welcome back to the Q Report. This is Ed. I'm with Patrick and Mark.
Hello.
Hey.
Just to catch everybody up, we have a race going on from the west side of Manhattan to the east side of Brooklyn.
They will be here by tonight, right?
No, they'll be here any minute.
Yeah. And we're finding out if, I guess it sounds like a vintage Mercedes can beat a hand-built bicycle. So
we're hoping for the bike.
We're rooting for the bike right
rooting
now.
Rooting for the bike.
We're also speaking to Professor David Diemer from UC Santa Cruz, and he seems to be a bit of a life expert. So
teaching us about the quotidian culture of the beginning forms of life.
This is a huge culture of a lot of people studying it, right? Dr. Diemer, are you there?
Right here.
So when we last broke, we were talking about the Murchison meteorite, which actually we didn't get a chance to talk too much about because we were doing your experiments in the sulfur vents in Hawaii. Tell us about the Murchison. It's very interesting, and where it fell and how old it is and what happened with it.
Yeah, there's about 10,000 or more meteorites now that have been collected. Some of them have been observed to fall, a very few, in fact, and the Murchison was one of these. It blew up over a little town of Murchison, Australia, and approximately 100 kilograms of stones from golf ball-sized up to brick-sized, I suppose, fell all around this little town, and people collected it. There's a very strange smell coming out of these, indicating there must be some organic content, and that was exactly right.
Life stinks for sure.
Yeah, it does. The material was just distributed all over the world to scientists like myself, and what I wanted to find out about it is whether there was material in it that could form the compartments of cells, the membranes around cells. And we did this work back in the early 1980s, in fact, and through the 1980s. And the very first experiments we tried just immediately began to work. There is a soap-like molecule that is part of the composition of the organic material in this meteorite, and it readily forms membranous vesicles. And we proposed at the time that this is a clear indication that self-assembling molecules like these soap-like molecules could have provided the very first kinds of membranes for the first cellular forms of life. And until then, we really didn't have a obvious source of this kind of material. So it's being now experimented upon both by myself and Jack Szostak at Harvard and Luigi Luisi, who's working in Rome. Quite a few people have picked up on this idea that fatty acids could have been a very primitive form of membrane.
Dr. Diemer, this is Ed. I'm curious, do you have any ideas of why these molecules want to self-assemble? You know, how does this happen? Is it just spontaneous? Is there an advantage?
Well, it is spontaneous. And it's spontaneous in the way that if you blow air through a soap solution, you spontaneously form soap bubbles. In other words, these soap molecules just have no choice but to assemble into what we call a soap bubble. Same stuff happens with the fatty acids, the lipid-like molecules that make membranes. They've got long hydrocarbon tails. These are oily, and they have what we call hydrophilic or water-loving head groups. And whenever you have that kind of a two parts of a molecule, both an oily part and a water-loving part, this turns into structures, self-assembled structures, and one of these structures is in fact, thin bimolecular membrane. And I'm sorry to get a little technical on you there, but the hydrocarbon chains want to get away from the water, so they point inward. The hydrophilic heads want to interact with water, so they form the surface of the membrane. And every cell of your body, in fact, contains a lipid bilayer that is stabilized by these forces.
Yeah, everything in life is based on lipids.
If it's a cell, it's got lipids producing a membrane.
Now, let me ask, I mean, does this change, how do you deal with the religious aspect of all this? I mean, doesn't that kind of throw upside down a lot of this idea that people have? I mean, it almost seems like medieval people or ancient Romans that are like, things can spontaneously become life, you know, and maybe they were right all along.
Yeah, Pasteur was the latest in that long line of history going way back, hundreds and hundreds of years, and Pasteur this famous experiment in which he showed that you cannot get spontaneous life, as they were defining it back then.
Right, spontaneous generation.
Yeah, spontaneous generation. You had to have pre-existing life. But the fact is that life began. It had to begin someplace, and these sort of forces of self-assembly, to me anyway, are the most plausible way for it to have begun.
Yeah, it seems like you gave an interview, I guess, to Susan Mazur, that is widely quoted throughout the intelligent design community. To basically,
I'm no kidding. I have to look into that.
that basically says that they don't think you know what you're talking about because of an answer you gave. "Quote: I think genetic information more or less came out of nowhere by chance assemblages of short polymers."
Yeah.
And I'm not a big fan of intelligent design. Could you do us a favor and just give us a quick definition of the scientific method and how it's self-correcting, and also technically what a theory is.
Okay. You know, I base that comment on an actual experiment, and in fact, many experiments, not of mine, but of the one I think is best illustrated of this is by David Bartel and Jack Szostak, who published this work back in the early 1990s.
Who, by the way, Jack Szostak is also in our documentary.
Oh, really? Good. Yeah. So what Jack did with his student at the time, David Bartel, was to produce trillions of totally random RNA molecules. And what that means is these had about approximately 300 bases making up the chain of the RNA. And it was just completely random. There's no order to it whatsoever. Then what they did was to begin to put a kind of a chemical hurdle that would select out certain molecules and leave others behind. And the hurdle they used was an enzyme reaction that we call ligation, where you stick two ends of a nucleic acid molecule together. You ligate them, so it's a ligase, in fact. So they set it up in such a way that they could pull out even a few of weakly active RNA molecules that happen to have this property of catalyzing ligation. And then they would amplify those. Then they pull that out again. They repeat the cycle and amplify that. Beginning with a completely random assortment of RNA molecules, in just 10 generations, they had produced two very distinct species of catalysts that were 7 million times faster in catalyzing this reaction than just the spontaneous reaction. So that's what I mean. You can pull information out of a random assortment of molecules if you allow selection, amplification, and in a sense, evolution to occur.
Somehow I don't think you're going to convince the intelligent design people, though. But
does that answer your question, Ed?
As far as the randomness, yes. But yeah, the thing you bump into with intelligent design is I think they misuse terms like theory.
Of course.
You know, they don't understand completely, you know, the scientific method and how it's observed. You know, you take your hypothesis, you try to prove it. If you fail, you move on to a new hypothesis.
And David, more to what Ed's saying, too, if we have about 30 seconds left. Let everybody understand that even if anybody, that there's a competition going around, a friendly competition around the world of people trying to figure out how exactly life began. But, of course, there's multiple theories because all of it may all be true. It's not just one way, that the Murchison may be the way it happened one way, and also volcanoes, also perhaps in volcanic vents at the bottom of the sea. Just explain that briefly. We have about 30 seconds.
Yeah, John Burroughs up at the University of Washington discovered some deep hydrothermal vents, 1,000 meters down in the Pacific Ocean. And it just occurred to John and others at the time that this might be a site of the origin of life. And again, this is a volcanic area. It's a, sort of a geothermal, hydrothermal vents, they're called. So this is a place where you do have chemical energy available. To me, it is not a place where self-assembly is promoted very strongly. Mm. And for that reason, I kind of like surface sites as opposed to the submarine vents. Mm.
Well, I hope if anyone ever asks me that question, they give me a full minute to answer it, not just 30 seconds. Anyway, David, thank Dr. Diemer, thank you so much. I mean, very, very interesting stuff. I mean, it really makes someone think, and fascinating.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, thank you for your time.
Happy to be there.
Thanks, David.
Bye now.
Well, we are back at Heritage Radio, and the victor of the race from 23rd and 8th, Robbie, come on in here.
Holy cow.
Oh, my God. Robbie, the car beat the bike. Yeah, just put those headphones on. Robbie, tell us about what route did you take? And
did you find parking okay?
Yeah.
Parking on Sundays in Brooklyn is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, you see, it's the Sunday advantage.
Yeah, we talked about that, Will and I did, before we left. He originally wanted to do this on a weekday at about 8 a.m. And he would have won at that time. But I had no doubt that I would cruise in here before him. Still haven't seen him. I've been back now
I think somebody should go outside and check the fenders of the tank he was driving. Yeah. Make sure there's no foul play.
Should we call Will?
I've been back now a full 9 minutes.
Does he know where Will knows, where Roberta's is, right? This is not an issue.
He was supposed to meet us here.
Robbie. No. Well, what route did you take from 23rd and 8th?
Well, from 23rd and 8th, I went down 23rd and I made a right onto Broadway. And then I actually went through Union Square to Broadway. I took Broadway all the way down to Bond Street, made a left on Bond down down the Bowery.
Interesting.
Down the Bowery to East Houston, down Houston to Allen, mm-hmm. made a left at Delancey, and right on the bridge, and then right over here.
So that's usually jammed. How long were you with Will?
Oh, up until 23rd and Broadway, when I made that right turn, I think he continued east.
Wow.
On 23rd.
Yeah, I think he was going to go towards 3rd Avenue and across. But
if I see any of Will's DNA on any part of that, I'm going to say it is.
And I ran, I had no idea where he was. I thought he might beat me, so... I was very
aggressive in
your
driving.
Very aggressive once I got the local Brooklyn area.
Did you take what did you do once you went in Brooklyn? BQE to Humboldt or
no? Not this time. No, straight down Broadway, which I've actually never done before. You know, there's like three ways once you get off the bridge to get here. And I went away. I've never went before, and I kind of was nervous about that. I still beat him.
Did you follow all traffic regulations?
No.
Okay.
No, no.
All right.
No, I cruised through a stop sign a couple blocks.
Robbie, will you stay with us? So we're going to cut to break. Will you stay with us for when and if, and I pray that he will, Will comes in?
Yeah, I'm here. He was really confident he was going to beat me, so of course I'll stay.
To gloat.
Yeah.
Well, you play that tarantella, all the hounds will start to roar. The boys all go to hell, and then the Cubans hit the floor. They drive along the pipeline, they tangle to their sore. They take apart their nightmares, and they leave them by the door. Let me fall out of the window with confetti in my hair. Deal out Jack's a bed on a blanket by the stairs. I tell you all my secrets, but I lie about my past, and send me off to bed forevermore. Make sure they play my theme song, I guess daisies I have to do. Just get me to New Orleans and paint shadows on the pews. Turn the spit on that pig and kick the drum and let me down. Put my clarinet your bed till I get back in town. Let me fall out of the window with confetti in my hair. Deal out Jack's a better on a blanket by the stairs. I tell you all my secrets, but I lie about my past. So send me off to bed forevermore. Just make sure she's all in calico and the color of a doll. Skillet on the wall. Cut me a switch. Oh, hold your breath till the sun goes down. Write my name on the hood. Send me off to another town. And just let me fall out a window with confetti in my hair. Deal out Jack's a better on a blanket by the stairs. Tell you all my secrets, but I lie about my past. Will you send me off to bed forevermore? But I lie about my past. Send me off to bed forevermore.
Send me off to bed. We back?
Yeah, we're back at the Q Report with Mark Mirabella and Ed Grant, and we have an excellent segment, which hopefully will be part of many segments to come. If you know Roberta's, you know Angela. Hey, Angela.
Hello. How are you?
Very good. Very good. Thanks for coming here. We're very happy to hear you, and we'll prove that with this. And here is Will, the race. The race is done. Only 11 minutes separating. All right, we'll have Will in here in a few minutes. But the biker has made it. He's alive.
With a smaller carbon footprint.
With a smaller carbon footprint. So, Angela, tell us a little bit about etiquette.
Well, it all kind of started, like in the last few months, I've been very interested in kind of sharing my knowledge of manners with friends, and especially New Yorkers. I am a Southern lady from Virginia, and I feel that I have, I know, yay, Virginia. I feel that I have very good manners, but they could always be better. And so I thought, hey, why not share them with the great state of New York, you know?
Absolutely. Do you find
they need it, that's for sure.
They fucking need
it.
That's not very polite.
Urban manners, I should say.
I know a few native New Yorkers, one in particular, who feels that the people with the worst manners in this city are the transplants.
That's true.
She will take you to task.
But not the Southerners.
She will take you to task.
The Midwesterners, of which I am one.
Is New York really bad manners, Angela?
There's certain things like escalators, you know, restaurants is a big thing, definitely. Retail, certain things. Yeah, people can definitely use some tips, and that's what I feel like I'm here to do.
Is there a specific tip today that we're going to cover, or what are you going to cover in the first thing?
And the first intro, I think mainly, like, first thing today was the top of my head right now is like escalators, like a big thing. I like was at a restaurant the other day, and they have an escalator like in order to get on the subway, and just people are just staggered, and so you're kind of just trying to like, you're like dodging people, you know, left and right. So it's like I feel like one side of the escalator is definitely should be deemed standing, you know, like in DC, if you go to the subway in DC, it's like that, you know, it's like a sign, there's photos like right side or left side is standing, you know, and the other side, whatever side that may be, is for walking. And so kind of maybe, yeah, if we can execute that. That would be amazing.
I have to say, I agree with you completely.
For sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you kidding?
Because I'm, you know, and I'm also like,
say the
on
metro,
the sidewalk, you know, you know, move to your right.
Exactly.
You know, it's how you drive, it's how you walk.
Yeah, that's right. You know?
But I how's a good way to approach dealing with such etiquette failures? Because I know the way I do is not the best way.
Yeah, all of us, you know, it's just like, take some time, you know, like, breathe it out, find your inner, you know, inner zen, you know, and then just kind of, if you have to address it, you address it, you know, but politely.
Just stampede around them and kind of shove them a little bit.
No, that's, I mean, I
make them
pretty vocal. I'll be like, you know, move to the right, get your head out of your ass. I mean, it's just like, you know,
make them pay for their indiscretion.
It'd be more polite if you said but.
That's true.
But now let me ask, this is the same thing with driving, right, Angela? I mean, people, the traffic is caused because people don't understand that the right lane is the standing lane in a way, and the left lane's passing.
Definitely.
Why is that? Like, you, I mean, and also it causes safety issues because people who imagine the left side to be a passing are presuming to pass, and then maybe they think that person on the left is going to walk, they don't, and...
Yeah, it's just, I don't know.
It's danger.
I feel like, yeah, this show is the first step, you know? First step into getting it out there, you know? Like, PSA announcement.
And what drew you this? Is this moving from south to north? You realize that there were a lot of kind of manner things that were kind of left to the
definitely,
wind?
Definitely, definitely. Like, even, like, in the south, like, I'm from Virginia, and you go, like, you're walking on the street, there's someone on the street with you, you say hello to them, you know? And here, it's just like, you're looked at like a psycho, you know? Like, why are you talking to me?
Like, yeah, I like
how
that.
How dare you?
I like
you know?
That part of being... I actually have to say, I lived in Norfolk for about seven years. And so some of the things I liked about it and some I didn't, like when I got my coffee in the morning, like, I didn't want to have a conversation before I got my coffee. So here, it's polite to sort of get on with your business and then chat. Whereas in Virginia, it's rude not to sort of chat and sort of have eye contact and that. So I had to get used to that, actually.
Yeah, you live just a few miles from where Angela's from, right?
Oh, yeah.
Suffolk and Norfolk and all that.
Mm-hmm. Suffolk and Norfolk, yeah.
Yes. Now, let me ask you one last thing. Is there a difference between Brooklyn and New York City?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I also work at another restaurant. I do the door. The name will remain nameless. But another thing is, like you walk into the door, it's not good manners, you know, to walk in and just like decimate all over the front host, you know, the door person, the busboy and whatnot, you know. It's like in Brooklyn, it's definitely more relaxed, I feel, you know, like you can kind of do whatever you want, you know, like the restaurant, same thing, you know, the management. But in the city, it's very, you know, it's regimented and the people are very like antsy, you know, and very rushed, important, you know, feel important and they have to be.
Oh, they are important.
Yeah,
they're super important. They will tell you how important they are.
Well, this has been excellent. Angela, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I really hope you come back. And
definitely.
I would love for this to be a weekly thing because, let's face it, we need more manners.
Definitely.
I certainly do.
World would be a happier place if everyone was very well-mannered.
Yes, it would.
My mother says it, by the way. You can't have manners some of the time. You either have them or you don't.
Yes. That's right. You can't have a little bit of grace.
Right, exactly. All right, well, we are going to come back with... Biker has arrived. He's about to light up a cigar.
Oh, no, I know. I lost.
You can't smoke.
Oh, he's smoking a stogie.
You don't know what love is. You think that it's a toy. A pretty little game played by a girl and boy. You won't talk about it. You don't even care. And you just take for granted I'll always be there.
You play, you stay away from anything that might be real. You talk and then you walk. I pray someday you'll know about it.
Approaching. Will has landed.
Yeah, Will has landed. Robbie, I know you know how to drive, so I'm going to open with Will because Will has done an amazing thing. He basically, like John Henry, competed with the machine.
But unlike John Henry.
Well, John Henry died at the end of that race, by the way, just so you know.
I arrived smoking a cigar.
John Henry smokes cigars, I think, maybe.
Yeah. Well, what route did you take?
Well, therein lies the problem, Patrick. As I passed the Williamsburg Bridge, I actually saw Robbie driving right past me. So that was the breaking point, was the Williamsburg Bridge. It was a pretty steep uphill climb for a biker who hasn't biked in a year.
Right.
Never ridden a mountain bike in Manhattan, and I may never again. But it was definitely it was an enthusiastic competition right up to the point where I couldn't blow through any more red lights. Robbie definitely took the better, the better route, I think. But if I'd been able to bike 50 miles an hour, you'd be done, man.
Oh my God!
I was pushing 60 at one point. I noticed.
if I had a road bike, which now having said that, I will have to get one. I think we'll have a different competition on our hands. But
1 week from today, buddy.
How was it?
A
when
week?
You got,
oh, pff,
we'll tomorrow.
When you crossed
tomorrow.
The bridge.
What's that?
How was it when you crossed the bridge?
It was actually beautiful. It was nice. I got to smile a lot of people. I got to wave. If you do that in a car, people think you're flipping them off here. And when you do that on a bike, people think you're being friendly. It was nice.
I was flipping people off on the way over.
Now, Robbie, you are very, you won by what? About in the
13
end?
13 minutes.
13 minutes. So, which is very small.
Yes.
I mean, now, there was gas. I mean, Robbie actually had a car. He had Severin's red biodiesel car. I mean, he had... he spent money on gas and, Will was on a bicycle, and he got healthier, and in a way. So, I mean, it's not completely even, in all fairness to Robbie. But I mean, it's just biking is still a good thing, although it might be a few minutes slower than car.
Robbie could have carried six passengers at the same time.
Absolutely.
Well, I actually could have carried another passenger at the rate I was going.
Not six.
but I think the trick is, though, you know, having built the bike myself, I got to learn a lot about the machine that I was using. And we both used machines, to be fair. But I don't think Robbie could have built a Mercedes from the bottom up.
Right.
Whereas I can build a bike in...
You don't know that about me.
Well, since you're driving one, I assume you don't build one because people that make cars don't use
them. I'm sure you can make a Yugo, man.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, a thousand monkeys can make a Yugo.
So, Will, would you be... What do you think would be a fairer competition? Do you think it's about where you started in the city, or do you think it's about lights or time of day? I mean, would a different time of day or week have been a different situation?
You know, any day that isn't the day after I helped move 10 tons of dirt with Patrick, the radio show host here, I might be a little better off. But to be honest, that long stretch of road where you can do 50 or 60 is going to kill a biker almost every time.
Right. How long do you think it took you to take that bridge? Like 4 or 5 minutes?
Ooh, had you asked me at the time, I would have said hours. It felt like a while. But it was nice because I was kind of like slowing down. And once I saw him pass me, I was like, well...
Mm-hmm.
Fuck it. And just had to check with Patrick on that. And I was like, you know, at a certain point, I'm actually out to enjoy myself now that Robbie has passed me, and I know I'll look silly regardless of how I arrive.
No, listen, 13 minutes, 6 miles is nothing to be embarrassed
that
by.
That could be the difference of a couple lights, even. You know, he gets the lights wrong.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a couple of times. And 8 a.m. on a Monday, forget it.
Sunday, too. That's interesting.
Yeah. Sunday, there's no traffic.
None.
Robbie and I talked about that before we left, and I still had to, you know, keep my ego going. So I said, you know, you're probably going to lose. But we looked at the traffic and it was a straight shot. There was very little on the road, and everybody that was going at the full speed of traffic. There was really nothing stopped.
Yeah. So. And Robbie, did you have light luck going on the crosstown? I mean, usually crosstown streets work against the flow of traffic,
no,
correct?
Well, on 23rd Street, it's generally pretty good. And I only went from 8th to Broadway, which isn't all the way across town.
Mm-hmm.
So it was okay. And then I came across the rest of... the crosstown on Houston, and that's generally always easy.
Mm-hmm.
So no, there's no problem.
There's still a little bit.
Yeah, no, there's no problem for me. It was fun. It was a lot of fun. I'm actually surprised that I beat him by 13 minutes. I thought he might beat me.
Well, Will is a, if you're with him in the studio, I mean, he's a big guy, a strong guy, and I think for a first race, you know, he definitely put up quite a fight on a Sunday, crosstown, 5-6 miles over a bridge. I mean, pretty good job. I think bicycle riders everywhere should be super proud.
All three of them.
I'm proud.
Well, thanks, guys. You guys are completely awesome for doing that. And hopefully, you know, we'll have more races.
I smell a rematch.
Absolutely. Rematch, maybe from a different part of town, like within Brooklyn.
And if there are any legitimate bikers with road bikes and serious racing fetishes, we should get them out there next time.
100%. Maybe we could start a movement of men versus machine. Men or women?
I think people. Yeah.
People.
People
awesome. Versus machine. Can I hit one of these buttons?
Sure.
You are correct, sir.
Nice.
That's awesome, guys. Music. Well, we'll come back in a couple of minutes with another quick bit on etiquette.
Children on the moon.
Q Report with a super exciting show, and we're going to conclude the show. I'm here with Mark Marabella and Ed Grant.
Yo, more manners.
With another skit. It was so exciting hearing about the escalators, and we know New Yorkers are very, very receptive to good manners.
And other people's opinions.
Wait a second. Yeah. No, but here we have, you know, Angela and your friend.
Mamie Claire Cornelius.
Mamie. And now you guys are going to do another etiquette thing. Now, why, Mamie, is etiquette so important to you? Bring the mic closer so you can...
Well, I think etiquette is important mostly because there's a lot of people in the world. We all have to live together. So I think that... it's important to put yourselves in other people's shoes and, I don't know, just respect the little space that we have here in this city.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, because we're starting to get a Southern versus Northern SmackDown, New York City, not New York City SmackDown. Where might you be from?
I'm from Alabama. I grew up in Florence, but my family lives in Birmingham now.
Hmm. Very nice.
I think where manners... were born.
Yeah, Alabama or Florence?
And just the South.
The South.
Yeah, the Southerners are very, they have a kind of slower...
We've got
maybe,
it together.
Yeah.
It's very slow.
Yes.
And yet, do you think manners and kind of ritual is kind of what's kept the South maybe not as, you know, dynamic economically because they have such roots and traditions and family, whereas in the North, maybe those roots and history didn't exist?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, there's still, like, debutante balls and things in the South and, you know, like, big pageants and things, you know, so, yeah.
I think it restricts them a lot from...
Yes.
Breaking out of the mold. I mean, they still won't wear white after Labor Day.
I think they're right, by the way.
No, and
way.
Last Labor Day, I wore all white just to really buck the system. And
you were ostracized.
They were like, "How dare you?"
Thank God I was in Boston.
Who is that person in white?
My roommate's like, "Mamie, you're the only one that still abides by that. Like, no one else does." Like, actually, in the South, they do.
I think that's correct, by the way. I have to say that, you know, I think most American culture is Southern culture. All the writers and the food, you know, the music.
Jazz.
I mean, in New York, you know, not so much is made here. A lot is sold here. But I'd say most of the culture is Southern culture, so it makes sense to me.
True American culture is Southern culture, I agree.
Go down the list. You know, jazz, country, rockabilly, rock, you know.
Writers.
Barbecue, you know.
Barbecue. You could talk about barbecue.
Jambalaya. You know, you go down. I mean, most of it is Southern cooking. I mean, there's some Western culture.
New England has given us boiled meat, man. Back off.
Yeah, that's right. You're a New Englander, Ed.
Good job, Ed.
There's a lot of culture there, too.
Thanks, Ed.
A lot of fishing culture up
there.
Do
you guys have a another bit of... I mean, the first bit of etiquette was about escalator etiquette, which is basically... The left lane is the passing lane.
Yes, please.
That's escalator. I would add driving.
I'd add that to the highway maybe, too.
Yeah.
Get
sure.
over.
Please.
I don't care if you go 55, but don't do it in front of me in the left lane.
Now, if you want to slow me down, that's fine. If you're like my mom or my uncle, but if I've never met you,
even
get
then.
Over. It's a being polite so that I can get my way. I love it.
I think that one of the... lessons my parents taught me, my dad taught me, that always applies to everything in life, every day. As he just said, always keep to the right. Just always keep to the right.
That's right.
No matter direction you're going, just keep to the
that
right
side. That sounds like a political...
yeah. But it works. Even in the office, I'm like, what are you... this is the right. I'm going this way. Like the stairwell...
You're like, I would press the elevator button for you, but I'm on the right side of it. I
my
can't
dad said,
reach.
Stay to the right. Everyone just stay to the right. Why didn't everyone get that memo? I don't know.
It's good until you're in England. It works everywhere else, though.
Yeah.
So do you guys have another little bit of, besides staying to the right?
I think, yeah, since we're on the north versus south, I think, like, Americans versus the pond, you know? Like, especially, like, server friends of mine have always kind of commented on just, like, being tipped in change, you know, from our lovely friends across the pond.
They don't really have a tipping culture
and
there.
Sometimes,
yeah,
it doesn't even add up to a full dollar amount. It's just like, here's 75 cents or 65 cents.
I know, you said something so funny, Angela. You were like, thank you for dumping your heavy pocket change into my
yeah,
pocket.
Totally.
Thanks a lot.
It adds up, though.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean,
true.
Like, What is worth the 75-cent tip anyway? Give the full dollar.
I don't know. They will not be parted with it. There's no tipping culture, and I'm always surprised by it. And I've actually embarrassed people I'm with tipping cab drivers in Europe. You know, they're like, "Why are you not supposed to tip them?" I'm like, "That's what we do here. I don't understand that."
Yeah.
That she's right about that. I mean, they're really stingy. Or maybe they actually pay their people.
Yeah, the servers are paid more than they are here. It's a much different system. I got that lesson in Holland.
Yeah.
I like to say something about donating to the homeless people on the street. This reminds me of Loose Change. I really can appreciate when a homeless person is asking for exact change. I just need 62 cents. Could you give me 62 cents? Man, please just have... I just need 23 cents. You're like, you know what? You're not even asking for a quarter. Here's two. Go for it. I can really respect that. I'm like, I know. I've been there before. We're all like, I just need 10 cents. Yeah. Seriously.
Yeah,
I can really respect that, and I appreciate that.
That reminds me of a story. Once there was this homeless person selling a newspaper, you know, like a homeless newspaper, and he was like, it's $1.50. So I gave him $2, and I was with a girlfriend of mine.
Was it like his zine?
Yeah, it was like Street News. It was like a newspaper, and it was like $1.50. And so I was like, keep the 50 cents. And my friend was like, no.
Yeah.
We're treating him like a businessman.
That's right.
You know, so ask him for the 50 cents back. And he, of course, had to look through his pockets and all that. So anyway, it's just to say that it can't be a complicated thing, because if you're trying to... you know, not be charitable. You know, charity has its place, but not in all things. But very, very many issues to navigate, to avoid. This is supposed to be a record scratch. That's what we want to avoid. A real problem. We're trying to avoid this.
That was Will on the Williamsburg Bridge.
No matter where it is. And there's a lot of things. And I think we've lost touch with our roots, our polite roots, and certainly a little etiquette lesson.
Bringing it back to origins.
Bringing it back to the origin and what's real, keeping it real.
Yeah, man.
Well, I guess the Q Report is done. We have a garden on our roof. Planted now with 3 tons of soil.
Yeah, and the roof is still holding. I'm glad.
Oh, yeah. I know. Everyone just looked up like, let's get the hell out of here. And this has been the Q Report. We're very, very excited, and we're about to cut to a farm report being introduced by our buddy Brian Kenny. By the way, we've forgotten all our sponsors. Hearst, TechServe, we love them. We have to start making a to-do list of stuff that we mentioned.
Yeah, we're all learning here. We're learning.
Yeah, it's just the fourth week.
And we love Hearst.
We love Hearst.
Brian Kinney will do. He can do extra promos in the farm report.
Maybe TechServe could start selling hamburgers or something from Hearst.
You could use them while you're looking at the fish.
Awesome, guys. Well, this has been unbelievable, and the car beat the...
That's just week one.
Car beat the bike.
Car beat the bike for now. Sunday, that's nothing.
It's a little disappointing.
It's Sunday. That's 2 days. That's 1 day out of 6.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone. Produced by Heather Hyman. Engineer, Nat Wiener. Ed Grant, Mark Marabella. We're out.
Thanks, guys.
Broken glass. Rusty nails. No, side of the road. There's a hole in the ladder, a fence we can climb. Mad as a hatter, you're thin as a dime. Go out to the meadow, the hills are green. Sing me a shattered his knees, but he stays in the sun.